This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Bolivia's poor and indigenous majority has fought battle after battle against a slew of neoliberal economic policies. In 2000, Bolivians successfully blocked privatization of the country's water. Last summer, social movements shut down the capital city, occupied oil fields, and forced the resignation of two successive presidents with their demand for nationalization of the oil and gas industries. Now these social movements are claiming as their latest victory the election of Evo Morales as Bolivia's president. Morales is the country's first indigenous president and is the leader of the Movement Towards Socialism, or MAS, party. Last weekend, during a swearing-in ceremony, Morales repeated his pledges to fight neoliberalism and return control of the country to the indigenous majority. Adriana Paz is a Bolivian activist and journalist living in Vancouver. She recently returned from Bolivia and has joined us in the studio. Good morning, Adriana.
Good morning. Thank you very much for having me here.
Thank you for coming down. You were in Bolivia at the time of the December election. Mm-hmm. What was the mood there since Morales has been elected president?
Well, the mood before Evo has elected. Well, I think the general mood, it's a lot of happiness and hope. And almost everybody, I mean, almost, I said almost because the businessman people, they are kind of afraid. They are just saying all the worst thing that can happen in Bolivia. But the general mood is a lot of hope and happiness. I think that the decision of the people of Bolivia to change the course of history by electing a total another type of government, it has been very, very clear. So the mood is happiness and celebration. And of course, there are certain uncertainties because it's totally new for the people to be on the power of the government. And there are a lot of hope and happiness.
After his inauguration last weekend, Morales announced the appointment of his cabinet ministers. Is this government structured differently than others have been?
Yes. The new restructuring of the government has been begun with main changes, like the creation of new and key ministries, like the Ministry of the Water and Mining, and the elimination of the Ministry of the Indigenous People. But those key ministries, like the Water and Mining, it's very strategic, not only in terms that they are going to pay attention, special attention to the recovery of the natural resources like the water and like the gas, but because the social movements that have been led to the resignation of the two presidents have come from that sector. The people who has mobilized for the water war and for the miners having also have played a great and key role on the recovery of all these natural resources. So it's not only to pay attention to the natural resources, but also to strengthen and to give to reinforce the organization of these sectors that are very, very the life and the energy of the social movements in Bolivia. So that's a very important change. And also talking about who is in the head of these ministries, this is also something very new that this government is changing, because usually the ministries are being given to the fat cats of the people from the coalition, from the ruling coalition. Now the ministries are in hands of the people, from leaders, labor leaders, indigenous people, and peasants, poor farm workers. So, and a small amount of leftist academics and urban people, we can say. But it's, for example, we have 16 ministers are indigenous, and they really come from the base. So that's a huge change, and that can put more pressure on making change fast, because these people that never have been before in these power positions. But I think it's a democratic revolution.
Are there any of the new cabinet ministers that you could talk specifically about?
Yes. For example, the water ministry, the minister of the water ministry, it's the leader, the labor leader of El Alto, who has led the struggle to recover the water for the municipality. So that's an example. The other example is, for example, the minister of the economy. I know that person. She's a woman. She's a peasant woman who came from the basis. So it's amazing that people like her, it's on the head of that ministries. And also the minister of mining, it's the leader of the miners. So that's a very concrete examples of the change that the Evo Morales government is doing.
What challenges do you think that these more popular or labor-based leaders will have now that they're running the country?
I think one of the main challenges is going to be are going to come from internally. I mean, the social movements are going now to press to the government, to their own ministers, to meet their demands in short-term period, and that's going to be a challenge to transform that feeling in a feeling of inclusion on the exercising of the power. So because there are a lot of expectations, and we cannot forget that Bolivia is still the poorest country in South America, so they want to see changes very soon. So transforming that feeling into an inclusion of the exercise of power. And well, the external challenge, I think, are the most worries challenge that this government is going to face, because the challenge is to join to the left regional bloc that Venezuela and Cuba and Argentina are forming. But meanwhile, Evo is going to still to have to negotiate delicate issues like the with USA, like the drug wars, like the NAFTA or ALCA, the trade agreements. So the challenge is how to join to the left bloc, but without still having to deal with the U.S., but from a point of view that with sovereignty and not from submission attitude. So that is quite a challenge to balance that.
Is there a lot of pressure from people's expectations of what this new government will deliver?
Yes, there are a lot of expectations. As I said before, there are a lot of happiness, but a lot of hope in the meantime. So the labor leaders and the bases have been saying last week ago that they are going to have patience, that they know that this is going to be a struggle for everybody. One struggle was to go to the power, and now it's to really keep in the power and trying to meet their demands. So they are like in a good terms, and everybody's willing to wait. So they are very conscious that their leaders need time and need support.
Nationalization of oil and gas resources has been a central demand of Bolivia's social movements and is something Morales committed to during the election. How is the new government approaching this issue?
Well, yes, nationalization has been in the center of the main struggles and demands and blockades for the last 2 years. So now it's a requirement, it's a demand that the mass have to address this issue as soon as possible. But there is a nationalization can mean different things for different people. There are the radical people in Bolivia, the indigenous radical party like the MIP of Felipe Quispe, that for them nationalization is means to have 100% of the ownership of the natural resources and the infrastructure of the oil corporations. But for different people means different things. And for the mass approach, nationalization means that they are going to still have oil corporations in Bolivia, but they are going to be partners, no owners of the natural resources like is right now. So they are going to deal with them in these terms. The state and the government is the owner of the natural resources, and the government is going to decide to whom, when, and
where they are going to transport and they are going to sell the gas. So it's a very different perspective and approach, but they cannot change the rules in a short-term period because first they have to hold the Constituent Assembly. That's the scenario to change the rules in order to be able to negotiate with a better conditions with the oil corporations. So the approach is that we still need the money from the oil corporations, but we are, but they are not only more the owners of the gas. So that's the mass approach, and I think it's a, they call it a very realistic approach and pragmatical approach, considering that Bolivia still needs the foreign aid. So we are going to use it, but from a different attitude.
Will this be enough for the more radical groups who want more complete nationalization?
Some of them, they don't agree, but these voices of radical voices, they exist, they are, and it's good that they are there, but they don't have too much popular support. Right now, the people, they are conscious that they are going to need time, the changes are going to come, but not very soon. And Morales has said that we are not going to see main changes on economy because they don't want to promise anything that they are not going to be able to achieve this year, but they have promised that they are going to set up all the necessary scenario for the Constituent Assembly. So that's now the Constituent Assembly is in August. So that's the greatest scenario to really end with the colonial state, as Evo Morales said, and to set new rules for to deal with the oil corporations and multilateral financial institutions.
What are your hopes for the process to rewrite the Constitution?
I am very, very optimistic. I think this is the time for Bolivia to really recreate refound the government, the new state. I think this is the great opportunity to give the power to the people, the constituent power to the people, and to create new rules to end with the colonial state. I think it's going to be a very difficult process because there are different confronted positions, people from different regions of Bolivia, they have different points of view, and there are different kind of ethnias and indigenous groups, and they have a different vision of the country. But it's so good that finally all these visions are going to get together on this important scenario. And so this is an excellent democratic exercise of the democracy. So I am very optimistic with this historic opportunity that Bolivia has. And I am pretty confident that the people is going to really take advantage and they are going to be able to refound a new state, finally, after 500 years.
Morales has been talking about how Bolivia now forms part of the axis of good in Latin America, along with Venezuela, Cuba, and Argentina. What do you think Bolivia will contribute to this network of left-leaning governments?
Well, I think as soon as Evo has been elected, the first thing that he did was to go to Cuba, right? Like saying, it's clear that we're going to join to the left bloc in South America, in Latin America. And then he went to Venezuela, which is also key. He went and he said, it's clear that we are going to make agreements and we are going to join to this left bloc. And in the last week have been made important agreements with Venezuela and with Cuba. So Bolivia is willing to be part of the large energy bloc that Venezuela with Argentina and Brazil are creating. And Bolivia is in a very key position in terms of geography. So Bolivia is willing to be the link between north and south and west and east. And it in infrastructure, but also in policies of redistribution, transportation, and to be partners of what countries. So this geographical key position, it's going to be one of the main contributions of Bolivia, but also, of course, the willing to be part of a left blogged. And Evo, it's funny because he always, well, I have to say that many people are like, well, USA, concretely, they say that, yeah, Evo Morales, it's part of this blog, they call the El Eje del Mal, it's like the evil edge. So, and it's funny because it's just an attempt to be to be joined to the left blog for Latin America.
Well, thank you very much for coming to speak with me this morning.
Well, thank you too much for giving me the opportunity to share a bit what is happening in Bolivia right now.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
I've been speaking with Bolivian activist and journalist Adriana Paz. You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM.
At 10 a.m. on February 1st last year, King Gyanendra of Nepal took over the airwaves and announced that he was dissolving the government and taking over the rule of the country. Within minutes of the announcement, all communication systems in the country were shut down by the Royal Nepali Army, and all civil rights were revoked. In the year since the coup, the civil war in the country has continued unabated, and the economy is on the point of collapse. Maddie Burnaby was teaching in Nepal at the time of the coup, and she remained in the country until July of last year. Maddie's been active in the Tibetan human rights movement since 1989. She's a high school teacher in Vancouver, and she joins me in the studio this morning. Hi, Maddie.
Hi.
What was the pretext the king gave for taking over power?
Well, the country's been involved in a civil war since 1996, and the civil war has become increasingly violent, and there has been a democratically elected government. There are issues with that as well, but his excuse or his rationale on February 1st was that by taking over the government, the democratically elected government had ceased to be effective, and somebody needed to take over to bring peace to the country, and he was the man to do it. Now, so that was his rationale.
Did he have any implication in whether the democratic system had succeeded or not?
That's definitely the feeling of most people in Nepal. He actually orchestrated the downfall. And, you know, officially that's not the case, but all of the, you know, journalists that I know, you know, everybody I know, including foreign diplomats, really feel that King Gyanendra created the downfall of the government, and then this coup had been planned for months. It had to have been planned for months in advance. It was too well orchestrated.
And what happened immediately after the coup?
Well, literally within minutes. I was actually at work that day. I was teaching in the American school there. So we knew that there was to be an announcement at 10 o'clock. The king was going to go on the radio. And people had suspicions about what it might be, but, you know, we had to wait to hear. At 10 o'clock, he went on the radio within a few minutes of his speech, he said that he was taking over and civil rights would be revoked. Freedom of expression, freedom of assembly, and of course, as I said, the communication systems were cut off. Telephone, internet, cell phone, mobile phone, those kinds of things. So literally within a minute, there was freedom of speech, and then there was no freedom of speech. The implications for that, in particular for journalists, were really interesting because suddenly they couldn't write freely, they couldn't speak freely. The army literally went into the newspaper and television offices and stood by and censored everything that was written and said. Journalists were arrested, human rights and peace activists were arrested. So, you know, the claim of bringing peace to the country, you know, wasn't born out, because the first people targeted were actually the people who were working towards bringing a democratic peace.
Well, let's back up a moment then. You mentioned that the civil war started in 1996.
Yes.
Why did it start?
That goes back even further, and there's a long history to it. Nepal is a Hindu kingdom. Up until 1990, it was royal rule. It was not a democracy. In 1990, there was a revolution, and a form of democratic government was brought in. There were holes in that. So there were elections, but there are a number of aspects that a democratic government should have that were not brought in, and in a number of human rights laws were not properly instituted. So by 1996, there was growing frustration. There were improvements in terms of freedom of speech, so people were starting to be able to argue and defend and look outward and look inward, decide what they wanted, but the government was not providing it. So a rebel group started, and it's become quite violent. It initially wasn't so violent. And the group calls themselves Maoist, and they were demanding, brought a number of demands to the government, many of which were things like promising education to all, promising rights for women, really, you know, bringing some basic fundamental human rights to all, regardless of, you know, gender, ethnic group, religion, etc. And the government did not comply. And you know, the democratically elected government was still dominated by high caste, you know, wealthy Nepalese. So that's really when the civil war started. You know, a group of people, particularly from the villages, who felt that even though it was a democratic government, still the needs of the people were not being served, and it was still being controlled by an elite few.
And this is taking place in a country, in a context where there is a lot of very deep poverty.
Very deep poverty, yes, and abysmal literacy rates. I believe it's still about... It's in the, maybe depending who's counting, maybe in the 50% range, but much less for women. There are certain laws that, even the citizenship laws are patriarchal. So if you can't identify your father, you'll have trouble claiming citizenship. And then most of your rights are, you know, you don't have the right to go to college, to, you know, to work legally. There are a number of things you just can't do. So... you know, there are real claims, you know, for concern around the structure of the government even before the king took over.
So when this, when the Maoists began their civil war in 1996, were they well supported by people in rural areas?
Definitely, well, yeah, I would say so. And you know, there's ongoing debate about that, but right now the Maoists effectively control about 80% of the land of Nepal. There's a definite feeling of Kathmandu and everywhere else. So Kathmandu is controlled by the elite, by the army, by the government, and their army everywhere. And I lived in Kathmandu, so there was this superficial feeling of security, kind of, except that there were a lot of army with guns, so that never leaves your conscience. The village is quite different. The Maoists were supported. Many people did join the Maoists. Over the years, the situation on both sides became more desperate and more brutal. So over the last, you know, since 2001, in that time, there are more incidents in which the Maoists are being accused of forcibly abducting people into their ranks. Right currently, as we speak, I'm getting reports from friends in Nepal, and there is an election scheduled for February 8th that it's, sounds like virtually everyone in the country is against, because the only people running are the king's friends, basically, and the Maoists aren't allowed to run. The party, the democratic political parties, are boycotting, and it sounds like right now virtually everybody is would rather the Maoists were given, you know, a footing to stand in and a place at the table. So they're bringing some important concerns.
Now, I mentioned in my introduction that the economy has virtually collapsed. Yeah. What were the causes of that?
There's a huge one is tourism, huge. And the, you know, with tourists don't flock to countries in the midst of a civil war. And that's, you know, that's just, you know, understandable. February 1st last year, that really got much worse. For most of the civil war, for tourists, the war has been an inconvenience. It's horrific for Nepalese that their country is in the midst of this mess, but you know, as an obvious foreigner, I'm Caucasian, so I have blue eyes. I'm an obvious foreigner. I'm not being targeted in any way, shape, or form. You know, there were a few incidents while I was in Nepal, and, you know, I was the only Caucasian person walking down the street, and there's sort of a, you know, bonfires, there are things happening. Nepalis who did not know me made sure that I stayed clear. They, you know, really are very protective. They don't want, you know, foreigners to be hurt. But so for the most part, most governments were telling foreigners to be careful, but it was okay to come. As of February 1st, they could no longer do that. So even the Canadian government put a travel advisory for Nepal and said, we can't be sure that communications are going to stay open. So if you go into the mountains and get hurt or something happens, and if the government cuts off all the phone lines again, we can't help you. So, and it's become more unpredictable. So really, tourism has virtually collapsed with the shutdown in communication and the the fact that it's just unreliable. A number of businesses that rely on internet are, you know, and foreign exchange, those kinds of things, trade, they've really collapsed. And so it's really tough for the majority of Nepalis. Many are leaving the country to try to scrape together some work elsewhere.
Yeah. What's been the reaction internationally to the coup and also to the repression that's followed the coup?
Most countries internationally have condemned both sides, both the king and the Maoists. But with the coup, like both the king and the Maoists and the army, who are under the king, you know, for their abuses of human rights, the king was absolutely condemned for taking over the country. That was not seen as the correct move, with the exception of China, who he wined and dined prior to that. There were some restrictions on Tibetans in Nepal that were in place 2 weeks prior to the coup. And later on, we realized that that must have been sort of the candy that the king gave the Chinese government to sort of buy their support when he did take over. So there are a number of things along the way that looked like that. India also wants democracy in Nepal. So the two neighboring countries really have different positions on it. The vast majority of the EU has condemned Nepal for this, or has condemned the king. Most countries in the world are condemning the king, but he continues on.
And you're going to be speaking later today about this situation as well at Café Kathmandu.
Yes.
Great. So we'll point people towards that as well if they want to find out more. Thanks, Maddie, for coming in this morning.
Okay, thank you.
Maddie Burnaby is a high school teacher in Vancouver, and she'll be showing slides and speaking about her experiences in Nepal at Café Kathmandu at 2779 Commercial Drive.